The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. It's just approaching 4 minutes past nine on this Friday. It's the 17th of July. You're very welcome along to the programme, and it's another busy one for you. As always, lots coming up in the second hour. The first hour is our Friday panel, of course, where we talk over some of the big issues of the day, big issues of the week, often driven by what's got the most traction from you, the listener, over the course of the last few days. So we tease it out, put a full stop there in some cases. 086 60 25 000, that's the WhatsApp, the text number, 086 60 25 000. You can give us a call on 074 91 25 000, or if you prefer to email, it's comments@highlandradio.com. let's welcome our guests onto the show this week. Let's say first good morning to Councillor Donal Mandy Kelly, Fianna Fáil councillor, of course, in the Letterkenny Milford Municipal District. Good morning to you. How are you getting on? Hello.
Good morning, Greg.
Oh, Donal, don't do that to me, will you not?
Good morning to all your listeners. Good morning. Very well, Greg. Thank you all.
Yeah, it's good to have you with us. We also have with us...
Can you hear me, Greg?
Yes, your connection's not fantastic, but it will sort itself out. We also have James Ward, news editor at the Irish Daily Mail. Good morning to you, James.
Morning, Greg.
Great to have you with us. And Patricia Sharkey, who's an environmental campaigner. Good morning, Patricia.
Good morning, Greg, and good morning to everybody listening to Highland Radio.
It's great to have you on, and I think we're welcoming you on to the show for the first time, this part of the show anyway, so you are very welcome. Garda Commissioner Justin Kelly has come out this week and said he absolutely supports an outright ban on e-scooters on Irish roads. The Taoiseach says he's leaning that way too, and we've also heard from medical professionals that say, I suppose, in the absence of enforcement of what we have currently, an all-out ban would make sense to them. But are we looking at a sensible response to a major public safety issue, or is an outright ban a lazy, knee-jerk reaction to a failure to enforce the laws that we already have? I'll start with you, James Ward. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think any time that you're reaching for a ban, first of all, then you're maybe not willing to tackle the issue. It does seem to be the kind of simple solution, sledgehammer to crack a nut. A couple of weeks ago, the Irish Daily Mail ran a story with comments from the Garda Representatives Association, Mark Ferris, saying that they wanted a licensing and registration plate system in place because of the difficulty that they were having policing them. The following day, members of Children's Health Ireland came out and raised the alarm about how many serious head injuries that they were seeing in young people in particular. That then led to the Taoiseach indicating that he was leading supportive of the ban, and the same line then from the Garda Commissioner. And what Justin Kelly had said was that while registration and licensing would be helpful to them, it would be extremely difficult to deal retroactively with the scooters that are already in place. And the reason that they're pushing for the ban, in addition to all the injuries that we're seeing among young people, they're very often used as effectively a tool by drug dealers, and young people in particular are being used as couriers. And the Gardaí are finding them very difficult to pursue, much like the scrambler bikes issue. And indeed, oftentimes the scooters are being used as a weapon. So there is a case against their use. But the government was very slow to regulate the area in the first place. In my view, they haven't gone far enough. They haven't fully explored the idea of putting a licensing system in place, making it 18 only, ensuring that you have training, much in the same way that you would need training and a license to drive a car if you're going to be using public roads. All of this hasn't fully been explored, in my view. They haven't really tried that level of enforcement. And the other side of it is, if you go back a few years ago, these vehicles were being touted as part of the solution to the climate crisis in government plans. They were going to form a key part of plans to help get people out of their cars and using more climate-friendly modes of transport. 2 years later, they're talking about an all-out ban. I don't think that that's the right way to approach the issue. And that's the views of government on this are very much going to be shaped by a report that's being done by Children's Health Ireland. That clearly is going to be focused on the injury side without maybe taking into account the wider situation.
Yes, but that would be like us allowing children to drive cars and then banning everyone from driving cars because there was a very sad increase in serious injuries to children. Surely you say, well, if you are found on one of these at a certain age, well, then, you know, then either you or your parents, depending on the age and all that, would be responsible. Because, you know, there's a lot of people going to work and college on these vehicles.
Yeah, and the vast majority of people using them aren't involved in criminality. They aren't involved in drug dealing, which is the aspect that seems to be driving the Garda response to this. And are we simply to say that those scooters that you spend 1,500, 2,000 euro on, you're no longer allowed to drive that and just take them off people? I think it's the wrong approach.
Yeah, it'd be hard to enforce because you've introduced these very lax regulations to allow them. People have spent millions upon millions, God knows how much, and then all of a sudden they're worthless. And if you actually ride it at all, you're, unless it's on your own private property, it's illegal. Patricia Sharkey, what's your reaction to this move, it seems, towards an all-out ban on scooters?
Yeah, well, I do think I agree with James. It is a knee-jerk reaction. I mean, what is the difference between our teenagers and those in Austria? You can drive an e-scooter at 12 years of age in Austria, 14 years of age in Germany and Italy, 16 in Spain and Belgium. So really, we have to ask the question, why are these teenagers, and it is a small number, it's a small coterie of people that is giving the rest a bad name, so to speak. I think that the license and insurance of e-scooters going forward would be a good idea. Then there would be a number plate or something on the scooter that would help the Gardaí identify a perpetrator if they're doing something wrong. But I think an outright ban is ridiculous. It is, in relation to climate and all that, a great way for people to get around this city. I don't see so many of them in Donegal now, in rural areas at all. But I think this is an overreaction. And also, like, give the Gardaí the resources in the big cities where they need them in order that they can police these e-scooters as well as they do cars and automobiles and noise, etc.
Yeah. And you talked about the other countries, the other examples. I mean, it probably is down to their policing. We have an overstretched Garda force as it is, and then a whole new level of vehicle was thrown in on top of their workload as well. So it's, I mean, it's like, you know, turkeys voting for Christmas, isn't it, for them to be retained? Of course, it would be handier for the guards if they were banned altogether. That being said, I'm sure couriers can go back to the push bike. And they can go back to electric bikes and all that manner of thing as well, Patricia.
Yeah, that's right. But I think banning is just ridiculous. It's just almost as if we're too infantile to have e-bikes in this country, which is ridiculous. You can go all over Europe when you're travelling. You see people using e-bikes. There's no big problem at all. I think insure them, license them. And also, it has to be said, parents should be more responsible. Don't buy your child an e-scooter if they're not tall enough and responsible enough to drive them, that kind of a way. And parents should be held responsible, I think, if their children get into bother when they're on these e-scooters or driving illegally or the wrong way. 15 kilometres as well would seem to be a better speed limit than 20.
Yeah, okay. Councillor Donald Mandy Kelly, you know, Patricia's quite right. You know, it's obviously not like Dublin or other major cities. That being said, they are part now of the traffic of towns like Letterkenny. You do see them quite regularly. And you know, we don't get a ton of complaints here. They seem to be able to coexist, and I haven't heard the Gardaí referencing them being used for crime in our part of the world. But anyway, with all that considered and looking at the wider picture, what do you think?
Yeah, Greg, and I suppose this is something that we have discussed on numerous occasions in the chamber. I think it was a bigger issue, particularly in Letterkenny. And the discussions we had with Gardaí Sé Conaí and even the Chamber of Commerce and our own roads section within Donegal County Council was particularly outlined in relation to e-scooters being used on footpaths, which we've seen numerous accidents had happened, and you know, thankfully we did get that ironed out. We do see scooters surely on our roads, but you know, this last number of months, thankfully, I haven't witnessed an e-scooter on a footpath. So, listen, for me, I think it's a matter of enforcing the rules that's already in place. You know, the age, the speed, I suppose the reflection and lights and stuff like that on these e-scooters. But, you know, Greg, I do understand why the conversation's been had, but I personally wouldn't be in favour of a total ban. I think it's more enforcement we need. I know we're Garda resources, they are stretched. They're doing their level best. But if you go back to cities, and before you even go to cities, I suppose our own rural area, and I'm, as you know, in Glens Holly, a rural area. And, you know, I see young fellas here daily meeting up with e-scooters, and, you know, they're out enjoying themselves. They have their helmets on, you know, and they're doing... I don't see them doing anything wrong, you know. But then you go back into cities and you understand, you know, if you're about Dublin there, an e-scooter, it's a great mode of transport for schools and colleges and one thing and another. And it's an easy way to get about, but there is definitely enforcements need to be put in place. For me, to ban them, I don't think it's right because, you know, realistically, Greg, What's the difference really between an e-scooter and an electric bike? You know, if you're going to start to ban an e-scooter, I mean, throughout the country, the government policy, I mean, they're promoting electric bikes. They're in nearly every city and town you go into. You see now where active travel has been put in place in towns like Letterkenny, and to be quite honest, you know, I don't see push bikes being used on active travel. But whatever chance there is of maybe a section being designated for e-scooters or electric bikes, then maybe. But I think, you know, it's kind of the government here now and the Garda Commissioner, they're kind of putting themselves between a rock and a hard place here. And I think it's a difficult one to get right.
I wonder how we would look on the international stage, James, you know, where, especially, you know, with the environmental questions into it and taking people out of cars and all that type of stuff, you know, and we do really care what our friends in Europe think. I wonder what they might think.
Yeah, well, we would be a bit of an outlier, but not entirely. I mean, the city of Paris did vote to ban them off the streets. The residents kind of felt that they were a nuisance and they were kind of fed up. And one of the things that you notice in European cities that you don't actually see so much here, they have the kind of the go e-scooters, that there's ranks of them and you can kind of rent them much like a bike. And they tend to be scattered around the streets. They get left kind of, you know, to one side and that kind of thing. So we're not unique in kind of being annoyed about this problem. But to go as far as to ban them outright at a time when we're lagging behind on our climate goals, and here you have an effective kind of green method of transport, it just seems like a retroactive step.
Now, we're seeing water restrictions introduced yet again in parts of Donegal and right across the country, hosepipe bans in places in a number of counties. And if the truth be told, it's not too long unless it rains quite dramatically soon until we see water restrictions across the board here. But at what point do we stop telling people to conserve water and start asking why a modern wealthy economy still can't guarantee a reliable basic utility without shutting it off as soon as the sun shines? What do you think, Councillor Donald Mandy Kelly?
Yeah, Greg, this is it's becoming a massive issue. Listen, I, for one, as you know, would have been very, very critical of SGN long before even we've seen water bans and that been put in place. Listen, it's hard to believe. For the country we're in, and particularly the county that we're in here in Donegal, there does be water restrictions put in place with the amount of rainfall that we have. But I suppose, listen, over the last, I suppose previously, this last maybe 2 or 3 years, we have got drier spells. We do see, and you'll know yourself, Greg, you probably travel that road more than any of us. If you go that way, you might go a different direction heading for Downings. But Lough Salt, I mean, I never in my lifetime ever remember a pump being in Lough Salt pumping from one lake up onto the main reservoir, if you like. And, you know, when you see things like that, it's alarming. With that said, I do, you know, I've been in contact with Eiscearn fairly regularly on different issues. But, you know, in recent times, Eiscearn, they have invested heavily here in Donegal, you know, and that has to be acknowledged. With recently, you know, they've spent of in and around 50 million there on the sewage treatment plant in Rathmullen and the works carried out in Kilmacrenan there as well. There's definitely more works needed. The infrastructure that's in place is certainly outdated. And I don't work for Eiscearn, but I would be fairly certain that the infrastructure on the ground is the biggest problem here, with busts and leakages that they're trying to detect.
But the government is constantly reminding us of climate change, and they're constantly telling us that the weather, not the weather, but the climate is changing. This is the future. They've set and are trying to adhere to major EU goals. They're trying to discourage all different forms of transport. So they know the climate change is a thing. That's the motivation for us all to try and change our behaviours, yet aren't using that information to actually plan then potentially for a drier climate. Now, it depends where you are. We could end up with a wetter climate. I don't know the ins and outs of it. My point being is that this information is out there. Surely now is when's the work should be done to try and ensure a relatively stable water supply if we end up getting a drier climate.
Without a doubt, Greg, and not even now, the work should have started on this years ago. We should have been getting ready for this. I mean, there was always, as you say, a lot of talk and conversations and policies put in place and legislations about climate change, you know, but we should have been, the government should have been out of their box sooner and getting infrastructure in place. And I mean, this is something, I suppose, only I can speak for myself as a county councillor and my colleagues as well, that we do drill home at every opportunity we get, that we need more investment. The government needs to put more investment towards Eiscearn for upgrade of infrastructure and supply, because at the end of the day, Greg, well, we're trying to push on, particularly in Donegal here, with future development. And at the minute, we don't have the supply to meet the demand that's there. And you know what, for me, it's scary going forward that we're trying to meet a housing demand. Mm-hmm. And we have great plans in place. But I'm very nervous of the water supply that's going to be there to provide an adequate supply to these developments.
Yes, because some of it is about when, you know, it doesn't rain, and then some of it's about literal capacity and the capacity for any further development. And obviously we often look to Spain and Portugal, but Spain, because when we go there, the taps are running and we can't make sense of it. But Spain does suffer with water shortages, water restrictions, as does Portugal. Portugal, not so bad at the moment because they've got a better system of capturing the water than Spain might have. But my point is that, you know, we do think that, well, how come there's always water in Spain and Portugal? They themselves do suffer water shortages. Did you want to come back in there, Donald, just before I go to the other guests?
Just on that, Greg, you know, I always see, if I'm not too often away right now, but if you're on Spain,
you're never in the country. What are you on about?
You'll always notice that nine times out of ten, their water pipes is actually running along the top of the ground. And unfortunately, in this country, we can't provide that with frost and harsh winters. But I think if we could have the same system, it would make life a lot easier. We're detecting leakages and stuff like that, you know. But listen, Greg, a lot more needs to be done. There's no doubt about that. And I hope that there is a firm focus on that.
And the bottom line is too, sorry to cut across you, that we cannot ignore the fact that in excess of 40% of Donegal's treated water is lost to leaks and bursts. 40%. I mean, that's massive. Patricia Sharkey, environmental campaigner. It's incredibly frustrating for people because, you know, if you're first on the supply, you might get it back on when it's scheduled to come back on. But I'm hearing from people aren't getting water to mid-afternoon, late evening, if at all. And they can't understand why, you know, it's dry for a few days and then seemingly, bang, here we go, water restrictions.
Yeah, it's really ridiculous. A country that, I mean, it feels sometimes as if it rains 330 days a year here in Donegal. One solution, I don't think that Irish Water should be piping water all over rural Ireland the way they are. It costs a lot of money. As you say, we have 40% leaks. And really, every one-off house in rural Ireland could have its own rainwater harvesting system. It's something I did myself a couple of years ago. I got it installed and it was the best thing I ever did because you're talking really about a euro per litre of water wanted for installation. So 5,000 litres, two big tanks, about 5,000 euro with a state-of-the-art osmosis ultraviolet system and that. And that could be put into each rural house. I mean, they're sitting out there in Gull Island now, waiting on Irish Water to fix an underwater pipe. Like, how ridiculous is that?
What is your water levels? What's your water levels like at the moment now, Patricia? I mean, obviously, you've been harvesting flat out when it rains. But have you still got water aplenty with this dry spell?
So far, so good. But I would think that I might put another tank if this was going to keep going in case you'd have visitors and that in the summertime. I mean, what are people doing in Donegal now that have no water and in a showing and they have B&Bs, Airbnbs, hotels, bars, cafes? Tourism is such a vital part of our economy here in Donegal.
But just to tease out this notion of rainwater systems, and it does sound fantastic, but I mean, you say you had an Airbnb or say you had, you know, teenagers, you know how much they shower, or say you had a bath in the house, you know, you'd be starting getting, we talk about range anxiety in electric cars, you'd be starting to have a bit of range anxiety now about your water, wouldn't you? And then what happens when it expires?
Definitely you would have if this weather was to continue. This is the first summer that we've seen a heat wave, so to speak. It rained every day bar three last summer from June 1st to September 1st. But, I mean, if we look at locally here, the Lettermack Award water system, Derek Moore Lock, which was running fine under the council for years and years and years. And now, instead of building a small reservoir at Fintown, at Port New, at Ardra, Glenties or whatever, this lock now is supposed to feed all of these areas and lay in pipes under roads again. Like, the councillor has a very good idea there. Like, why don't we have above road piping?
I presume it's because of the cold winters. I mean,
America, sure, they have them in concrete tunnels, small vents, 2 foot above the ground. All over, all utilities, water, electricity, gas, whatever, are all going in these utility, they're about 2 foot off the ground, concrete corridors alongside roads.
I'm not being smart, but I don't want to talk about the 6,500 metres of concrete around Donegal protecting the water. That in itself wouldn't be fantastic.
Digging up the roads isn't very practical either. We should be trying to harvest water locally to villages instead of piping it for loads of kilometres, 20 kilometres, and then wondering why the pressure isn't great or why we're getting organic matter or why there's a leak.
Yeah, okay.
Irish Water spent $1.37 billion in 2024 on infrastructure, but it's obviously not enough. So with the years of neglect, when the county councils were doing their best on very small budgets and doing a great job, for those years of neglect, but on the general infrastructure around the country, really, the government will have to step up and spend more money. That's
That's just
the most important resource we have.
Yeah, I'll come back to you, of course. James Ward, obviously, you know, around Dublin, there's a large number of counties that are facing a hose pipe ban, as they call it. What we're doing here, effectively, from what I could read between the lines, the overnight restrictions are a pathway towards the very same measures being introduced into Donegal. What's your overview of the water situation in the country?
Well, I think that we often mistakenly kind of think of Ireland as a country that has very plentiful water, but you know that always, you know, we get 5 days of sunshine and that picture soon unravels. We don't have very plentiful water in this country at all. 39% nationally is still lost to leakage. That's a figure that's come down in the last few years, but the development of an infrastructure hasn't been anywhere near fast enough. And I think Patricia makes some very good points there. I think we sometimes suffer from a lack of imagination in this country and how we approach problems, much like the ban on e-scooters or, you know, the water pipes. We've always put them in the ground. That's the way it's done. Why aren't we looking at alternatives? If, you know, we know how disruptive it can be, we know how slow it is to upgrade. You know, we're never going to plug all the leaks if that's the manner that we go about it in. And I know Donegal in particular has had a lot of hosepipe bans in place in recent years. If this is the new reality in terms of what our summers are going to be like, we need to get on top of it very quickly. And one of the things that really annoys people, I think, is that you know, these are restrictions placed on every household in the country. Irish Water paid 13.1 million in bonuses to staff in 2024, which is the last year we have the figures for. You know, at that time, 60% of treatment plants weren't meeting their goals set by the Environmental Protection Agency.
So we're rewarding poor performance there. You shouldn't be getting those types of bonuses, that type of remuneration, overseeing a flawed system, surely.
Absolutely. I mean, why, you know, what's the incentive to step up your game and to really tackle the issue if you're getting that kind of, you know, pay package? You know, there's 400 staff in Irish Water earning over 100 grand a year. And where's the incentive to actually go out and tackle the problems?
Mm. How big of a, I mean, it is in terms of building Donal Mandy, the reality is, you know, say for instance in the Milford area, there probably shouldn't be another house connected to that supply because it's under strain in the depth of winter. We see in Inishowen to that system that currently is there under strain. I mean, this is a big hindrance, isn't it, in terms of the development? Like, how much of a factor is the water supply when planning permissions are being considered? Because a caller quite rightly says, you know, until we get this sorted, why are we being, you know, why are we allowing any houses to be built at all?
Yeah, Greg, listen, it's a very valid and fair point, but listen, I suppose it's back to being stuck within that rock and a hard place. We are in a housing crisis. We're in a weather crisis now with the summers that we're seeing. But for a long number of years, Greg, there was no development, you know, and we've pushed very hard to get development back up and running and the construction of houses to meet the demand that's there. And thankfully, we're making very good progress on that. And that's a must. I understand, you know, we need the weather facilities and infrastructure in place to do that, but there's no doubt about it. The elephant in the room is Eskairn. And, you know, before any development goes forward, and you touched on Milford there, which an area I wouldn't be as familiar with weather-wise, but even in my own area, like, we see the development there that has gone through planning at Ballymacool, for an example, an area out here that has suffered weather issues for the last number of years. Thankfully, I have got that ironed out through the help of Eskairn, but... But, you know, before that development went through, I was very adamant in the chamber and at every opportunity that I was given a commitment that the infrastructure, the water infrastructure and sewage would be there to meet the demand. And I was given that. So I hope that Eskairn stand up and be accounted for. And listen, I suppose as county councillors, it's our job to keep the pressure on them to ensure that they do stick to their word. And
that's if you can get a meeting with them.
Well, that's another point, Greg, and as you well know, it's
we'll open that can of worms. Yeah, okay, stay there. Councillor Michael McCrafty says, Gola Island currently has no piping. Irish Water lifted it with the promise of replacing it. That hasn't been done yet. It was lifted in December, which is much of what effectively Patricia said. There's constant building around the county. If there's no water, why is this building being allowed? We reference that. It's the rock and the hard place, isn't it? On e-scooters, if the rules were adhered to, there'd be no problems. They're constantly on footpaths in our area and would run you over, and Gardaí aren't finding them. Another, the reason that there's so much carnage on the roads is because there are so many cars on the roads. E-scooters shouldn't be allowed. They should have to walk or buy a car like people did back in the day. People themselves should be in charge of their own safety. But you reference there the amount of cars on the road, and that would actually drive more cars onto the road, surely. A texter says, ID wallet, the start to the end of free speech. E-scooters is a deflection. It's never going to get rid of them if banned. It's nearly all new to the parish that have a scooter. Oh, does that make me far right? No, I wouldn't have. I don't know what you mean. Well, I think I understand what you mean. I see all manner of people on e-scooters. Just on the digital wallet, because I know it's been written about extensively in the Irish Daily Mail. Hopefully you read your own paper, because I'm going to ask you a quick question.
I'm aware of it, yeah.
Plans to use the government digital wallet as an age verification tool for social media and adult websites have hit a stumbling block as the new app cannot be made mandatory under the EU. What is the story with this new app? I don't mind this stuff. Like, I don't mind Google tracking me. Anything that makes... I've nothing to hide. I don't really care what they do with my data. Anything that makes my life a little bit easier, I kind of tend to, you know, be encouraged by it. But what's the digital wallet? When's it coming in? And why are the EU sticking their nose in?
So it's going to be a new app that you download to your phone, and you'll access it using your MyGov ID that you would use to access revenue or any services like that. That's going to be introduced next week. It's been a long time in the making. It'll store your driver's license. It would store any educational certificate you have, your leaving cert, your bachelor's, your master's, whatever it might be. Any of these documents you kind of need to get about in your day-to-day life. Only they'll all be on your phone, and they'll be easily accessed, and you can use it as ID to enter the pub or if you're going to the Pulse or whatever else. So there are a lot of concerns about it, and the Public Expenditure Minister, Jack Chambers, is writing in our newspaper this morning kind of defending it against this. The government doesn't particularly want to know or care.
I love the quote that you use. Don't let conspiracy theories cloud the facts about easy access to state services. Instant red flag to anyone who's of that mind.
Yeah, it will. And it's nearly by virtue of it coming from a government minister, people might distrust it a little bit. And that's just the nature of these things.
What do those who are concerned about privacy and data have to say about it?
Some people say that it's a method for the government to track you. I don't think that the government really cares about the minutiae of your movements. Unless you're involved in criminality, and then it's a matter for the Gardaí and not the government. That's my own personal view. I don't think there's anything really to be that concerned about. If you're signed up to Instagram or Facebook or Twitter or any of these social media sites, all of the major tech firms know exactly what you're doing all the time. And this really is no different from that. Where the EU comes into play, the media minister, Patrick O'Donovan, had wanted to use this as an age verification tool for social media. You don't get this this digital wallet until you're 16, until you have your PPS number. So de facto, you wouldn't be able to access social media sites or adult websites unless you had this on your phone. Now, the EU says that this app cannot be made mandatory, has to be voluntary. So if you don't want it, you don't have to get it. You can stick to your physical documents if you want. That's not an issue. But that creates a problem then for the government in terms of using it as an age verification tool, because they have to introduce other measures alongside it as well, which would usually be either a third party introduces an age verification method, or you ask the social media companies to do it themselves. That's the model they've followed in Australia, and it doesn't appear to have been very effective.
What's your feelings about your data, Patricia? Would you see this as something handy, you know, a digital wallet on your phone that's presumably, obviously, if your phone was lifted, it would have to have very strong security so people couldn't access it, which often makes these things quite complicated to log into. But anyway, would you see that as a welcome development or a bit of a data and information grab from the state?
Well, I think the state already has any information they want on people. It's just the format. I don't know about having everything on the one data set. You don't want your education and your medical information on the same thing. You have your car or that. But I also... The idea of free speech on the internet is one that's very important. 16-year-olds, I think that the children are being used in order to bring in digital ID, in order that if you are a subversive or engaging in something nefarious or just free speech that the state doesn't agree with, that this age thing, so that you would be stopped going on the internet unless you had a digital ID. Well, that would mean then that you would effectively, I know we are being traced by all the cookies on the websites of everywhere we go, but it would mean that people would be restricted from using the internet unless they had this digital ID, which is anathema to free speech, really. I mean, I'm on the internet now. I was at the very first internet display in 1992 when the University of California and Trinity College hooked up, and that was the very first time that there was any internet in Ireland. And I've seen how it's developed over the years, and it's really not what we envisaged back then. We envisaged that people would be able to do commercial transactions way back in the early 2000s, but none of that happened.
But but the reality is we know what drove the popularity of videotapes. We know what drove the popularity of DVDs, and it wasn't The Jungle Book. You know, it's often these things are repurposed and retooled. Like X, the majority of X's traffic is actually pornography at the moment, which people perhaps do or don't realise. It's certainly very high if it's not the majority. I'll double check that. So, Patricia, the reality is, though, if we're going to protect young people from the internet, the only way we do that is everyone has to prove who they are and their age.
No, really. Surely parents should be policing how their children use
the internet.
But we
can't rely on that. But that's why we have so many rules and regulations, because that doesn't work.
Well, the rules and regulations aren't working either. Mm. I mean, that introduction of nobody under 16 using the internet in Australia, it hasn't worked. It's a big debate. It's one that we really do need more of a public debate on.
See, the one thing that people say about the Australian thing hasn't worked, and maybe that's measured purely just by numbers, but surely the measurement of it would be the harm to children. You know, we'd have to wait on data to see in terms of, you know, body dysmorphia or abuse or being groomed. Or, you know what I mean? Those are the important metrics, not really if... You know, a certain amount of them are finding a way around it. Isn't that really the true test of whether it's a success or not?
Yeah, it will take time to see if those rules are going to work. But children would find a way around it regardless. You know, they know more about the internet than adults, and they know their way around all the apps and that. I don't know. I mean, really, we're hosting all these data centres in Ireland and we haven't a clue what's stored on them.
Everything.
You know, we know that there's we know that there's three continents' backup data from all of the main social media hosted in Ireland. Mm. But how much of it is pornography, how much of it is hate speech or whatever, we don't know what's been hosted in Ireland. So, I mean, we need to look at that as well.
What do you think, Donald Mandakelly? Would you favour something like this? I'm not sure if internet's fully reached Glenswilly, judging by the quality of the Zoom call. But anyway, go on.
Good job, Almond Drummond, on the side, you know, Greg.
The size, yeah, I know. Go on.
Listen, I suppose part of what you're saying, I'll agree with what you're getting at, I should say. Listen, I would personally be fairly, I would class myself fairly old school, all right, you know. Personally, I feel that we're somewhat being controlled and people are kind of losing their privacy as well. And that's something I wouldn't have something I do have a strong view on. I wouldn't be in favour of. But personally, I don't really like the way the world is moving electronically. But I suppose there's not much I can do about that. But with that said, we have seen a lot of benefits as well in regards to broadband and rural areas. You know, things have moved very positively in some ways, and other ways not so positive. And I do think there's ups and downs to the whole process and the way things is moving. But you know, I think I was probably lucky enough, Greg. My generation, I'm not that much younger than you, but I'm wee. But listen, I was lucky enough, I suppose, the generation that come through. As the youth nowadays coming up, you know, I think, you know, it's a difficult enough time growing up. There's just so much at hand.
It's very difficult.
With phones, yeah, and everything. But listen, I go back, I would agree somewhat with Patricia. I think, you know, parenting has a lot to do with it as well. You know, you can't put it all on the parents, but, you know, you can't watch, I suppose, everything that's going on. But, you know,
I understand what you're saying, but we have to understand too that we live in a society whereby, you know, for various reasons, and I'm not saying this is bad parenting, but the reason the school meals is because if there isn't school meals, children end up being malnourished. Now, there's lots and lots of reasons for that, don't get me wrong, but there's lots of reasons why a state has to get involved. You can't constantly rely on parental responsibility because you have to make sure all children have the best chances.
Oh, without a doubt, Greg, and you know, I totally agree with that. I think there's no two people should be treated any different. Everyone should be treated the same.
James, it's hard for me to trust the government with my data, even though I don't really care. When, you know, tech companies tell me my phone's not listening to me and fashioning ads off my microphone, I know it's happening, right? I don't even think that's tin hat stuff anymore.
Not at all. I don't think anybody who owns a mobile phone believes that tech companies aren't listening to them and haven't been for 10 years or more. That seems to be a price people are happy enough to pay. Unfortunately, maybe it was a case that the horses bolted before we knew what was happening. But it's a tricky area to get right, but I do think that there is merit in the argument that young people in particular shouldn't have social media, because it's not something that you can monitor. If you go back to when we were children, you know, any kind of film or television that you're watching, your parents can just look across the television and say, that's not appropriate. I don't want my child seeing that. You cannot do that with a phone.
No,
you don't know
no.
half the content that they're, you know, being subjected to.
It's actually and you know what we tend to do? It's actually so overwhelming that sometimes we just bury our heads in the sand, I think, because it's just what gets us through the day, because parenting is tough enough to begin with. James, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. James Ward, news editor of the Irish Daily Mail. Keep up the great work. Thank you very much indeed. Donald Mandy Kelly, thank you. And my criticism of was only the quality of our internet connection. It could be that you're far from the router, but it held up for us fine. No offence, don't beat
me up. I'll meet you again in the long grass.
Oh, no, right, okay. Good luck. See you, Donald. And Patricia, you'll come back, will you? You're a debutante. It's been lovely having you on the show. An interesting, actually, little fact that you slipped out there about being visualised as part of the first sort of internet connection between the States and Ireland. A lovely little feather in the cap. But it's been lovely having you on, Patricia.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Look after yourself. Take care. Right now, let's see. On the digital wallets issue, you don't have to take it if you don't want it. You just can't go to work or go shopping. Oh, wait, that's what they said about the COVID injections. Deja vu happening with the correlation between the digital wallets and the COVID injections. That's your view, and it's not for me to try and change that. On the issue of the digital wallet, why has Ireland implemented the Chinese digital ID system? On water, Irish Water should be building dams in areas like the Mountain Top and Mina Roy, similar to the Pollen Dam. Staying with that issue, we built our house in 2009. There was no water main availability, so we had to drill for a private well. Now we see a couple of million euro advertised for new water main infrastructure in Glenfinn. We've managed for over 15 years on our own well, and we won't be connecting to the mains to have our water turned off every time we have a dry spell. Indeed, well, and you've spent the money now, so you can reap the benefits. Morning, Greg. I live out Ballyrain direction, and there are a lot of people flying in and out the road past Arena 7 on scooters. My question is, has the government informed people who don't have English or Irish as a first language what the actual rules of the road are for scooters? I have a funny feeling they haven't. People need to know the laws. They probably don't watch RTE News or listen to Irish radio. And I've said that in the past. You have to make sure all the information gets out to everyone. A caller says there was a crowd hassling the dolphins with jet skis out in Coldaff yesterday. They harassed them like a dog harassing sheep. It drove the dolphins mad and they left yesterday and haven't come back since. Like, you know, this is going to be a little bit like a small group of people with jet skis giving the rest a bad name. You don't be at that. Although, what is hassling? Like, were they circling them and trying to intimidate them or just trying to go up and have a look? I don't know how you define hassling. On the issue of water and planning, when you now apply for planning in rural Donegal, you must also apply to Irish Water to see if there is water in your area. Is that a new thing, though? I would have thought part of any planning, a new build, would be permission from Irish Water as to whether or not you can tap into the mains. Is it about the ability to do that and the cost, etc., or is it actually about whether or not there's enough water in that area? I don't know. Maybe it's both. Greg, water out in Lifford, it goes off at 8 p.m, goes back on at 8 a.m, but I have to run the kitchen tap for at least 20 minutes as it's cloudy and smells of chemicals. So a lot of water is quite literally going down the drain before I get a cup of tea. What's that all about? Yeah, indeed. And you're lucky there's some people on that supply don't get it back at 8 because it takes a while for it to meander up and you're running your tap, which I understand. I'm not being critical of that. But someone further up the line then, that's reducing their pressure to get any water at all. Pay less wages to the high earners in Irish Water and build more reservoirs, says a listener simply. Another, Donegal County Council and Irish Water have more funding than most Spanish, Turkish, Portuguese municipalities. But for some reason, 2 days of normal summer weather leads to a hose pipe ban. The question would need to be asked, what is DCC and Irish Water doing with the massive funds they're in receipt of? And in this instance, the responsibility was taken from the council and given to Irish Water. Not sure what Greg is talking about as regards to his comments about the levels of porn on the X platform. It's the only platform I use and have done so for many years and never have come across any porn whatsoever. Strange comment when you see what's going on the platform called Blue Sky. It's not a criticism of it. And listen, Elon Musk doesn't need you defending him. He's a trillionaire, the richest person in the world. But that being said, I understand where you're coming from. It's their own data. 14% of all content posted on X is pornography, and more than half then of the traffic on it is people accessing that, and that's their own data. I'm not making it up. I'm not criticizing them. I don't know what's going on in Blue Sky, as I am not there and I don't really use X anymore. But listen, as I say, I understand where you're coming from. I'm just telling you that's, you choose to use it that way, but that's what the majority of people use it for. Downing's, obviously we talked about this extensively at the start of the week. Downing's got a heavy hit last weekend. No fault to the local people that live there, the regulars that holiday there, and also the businesses that work hard in providing a fantastic welcome for everyone landing there. What happened last week was a whole group of predominantly young people descended on the village. And most of them were sleeping in cars and stuff. But this caller says, what's actually going to be done about incidences in Downing's? I've been going for years and I've never seen anything like the weekend of the 12th of July. What used to be a beautiful place was like a kip, they say. It'll be the same at the Downing's Festival again if Gardaí don't get involved. I found condoms, drugs on the beach along with lifebuoys, broken glass everywhere. Milford Gardaí don't come to the area anymore. Well, they were there, but I take your point, you probably don't feel enough. There are not enough Gardaí. They're run by Ballyshannon. Not that area. Creasla is, but I don't think Down is. But anyway, the cleanup continued well into the week. In my opinion, the media coverage was only the tip of the iceberg. We need to keep putting pressure on our councillors to campaign for more Gardaí and to shut down the beach. But you see, you know, you go to Downing's Beach or any of our beaches there Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and it was full of families. And as I said earlier on, I saw one family with a child with additional needs able to take the car into the beach, and the child was able to enjoy the sand and the sea with her or his siblings, and that could have been complicated with a ban on cars. So it's complex, but I understand where you're coming from. Chloe Doherty and Dale getting married today in Clonmany from Uncle Neilis and the gang in Letterkenny. Have a great day, everyone. Now, the podcast, the latest Greg Hughes podcast, comes out at 11 o'clock. New episodes for you every day, every Friday at 11 a.m. They are published, of course, on the Highland Radio website or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search the Greg Hughes podcast. Now, breathe. And imagine stepping into Glenveagh Castle in the 1950s, a secluded world of absolute luxury, global power players and Hollywood royalty. At the very centre of that world was a young man from Dunluce who had gone to spend decades as the ultimate high society insider, jet-setting between the hills of Donegal, the exclusive circles of Philadelphia and the beaches of Hawaii. That man's Patrick Gallagher. And in this clip from the latest Greg Hughes podcast, we go right back to the very beginning of an extraordinary journey. We pick up the conversation in the 50s when a teenage Patrick first walked through the doors of Glenveagh to work under the legendary Henry McIlhenny, alongside his sister Nellie and brother Dermot. Here's Patrick taking us back to where it all began.
Well, I was classed well as a second footman. I did the fires, maintained the hot water boiler, you know, built it with turf. And we didn't call it the hot water boiler, we called it the donkey. And I had to keep fires going from about 8 o'clock in the morning, and then in four public rooms, the dining room, the study, the drawing room, and the music room. And also kept lamps all in shape. We didn't have any electricity then. Glenveagh didn't get electric power until 1959. So from my time, from 54 to 59, it was oil lamps and, right, and tilly lamps. Have you ever heard of tilly lamps?
Are they not paraffin, no?
Oh, they were paraffin, but yeah, they were...
That's the shape of them?
No, they were sort of a vaporizing system with a mantle on them.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't have been used in only in the rear end of the house, in the kitchen and the pantry and all. But they give a better light.
Yeah.
They came on the market sometime around 1949 until the electric came in 59.
What was it like? It must have been quiet. You know, the one thing about modern life, there's always noise, you know, generated by electronics or whatever it might be. It must have been was a peaceful place to work, you know, with just the...
Oh, there were certainly no noises. We did have two refrigerators, two American ones. They were up run by paraffin oil.
Right.
They were imported in the late 40s. And they were made by a company called Kelvinator. And that was another chore I had to do to fill those tanks once a week. Also, I had to clean shoes for the guests and carry luggage to their bedrooms, and whatever other odd jobs had to be done.
And were these sort of highfalutin fancy people that would have been landing, or...?
Well, they were all grand society people, right, mostly. Very, very nice people to talk to.
And they were nice to you?
Oh, people who are well-educated and are rich are the nicest people to talk to, yes.
Okay. What about the tips?
Tips were very good in Glenveagh, because when I started Glenveagh, I was making £3 a week.
Mm. Now, 1960, that's sort of, what, 6-7 years after you first began there, you, I suppose, moved up, did you? Well, was that how you would see it?
The man who was the first footman, he went off to Scotland in 1956, so I moved up to his position. That meant helping the butler serve meals, mm, and setting the dining room tables and the breakfast trays for the ladies.
But this would have been all stuff you had observed over your time. So did it come relatively easy to you?
The next stage, yes, it did. Yeah. Yes, of course, you were there watching what was going on. And also we had to clean the silver every day, whatever was used.
Now, imagine that. Yeah, you talked about sort of high society. You know, what kind of names or of note would have came through the doors, say, in the 50s into the 60s? I'm just curious as what kind of people may have sort of visited the...
Well, Mr. Mackinley used to always come to Glenveagh by way of London. In the early years, he may have flown directly into Ireland. But later, he always stayed in London a week and he would meet people there, been invited to parties, and he would say to them, well, if you're in Ireland this summer, look me up and come and visit.
And this would have just been heaven on earth to these people.
They were usually people, titled people, lords and ladies. Let's say the Duchess of Westminster would be one person who would come on a regular basis. Lady Diana's father came, Lord Spencer.
And where were they staying? So what was the building? Just explain the layout. Where they would have been coming to visit Dunluey.
Not Dunluey, sorry, beg your pardon,
Glenveagh. So the Glenveagh, I'm just trying to paint the picture for listeners here. So the Glenveagh that we're familiar with now was in that building, that house. Is that where you were working?
Yeah, that hasn't changed anything. The layout of it hasn't changed anything.
But the thing is because it's kind of open to the public between different events, you know, many people listening to this will be familiar with the layout and the beauty and grandeur of it.
Well, it had about 12 guest bedrooms. You know, some were single, but mostly were doubles. So he would organize his weekend parties around the inviting a couple or inviting single people. And he liked to mix American guests with the English ones. He said it made for better conversation.
And was this just to satisfy his own social desires?
Yes.
There was no ulterior motive. It was
like a free hotel. Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll get through some of the names at the moment, but some of these are the who's who of you know, the social circles, the media, etc. Would have been local knowledge that Ian Fleming, the man behind James Bond, was in town?
No, nobody would have known who he was or never wouldn't have heard about it or they wouldn't have known who was at Glenveagh.
Which is quite remarkable. Were you instructed to keep it quiet or was there just no public hunger for the information?
Ian Fleming wouldn't have been well known as a writer then. He came in the early sort of 54, 56, around that time.
And what was he like?
Well, he was just an unassuming man, very quiet. I didn't know who he was. I never heard of him before.
Nor were you interested, probably. Were you?
Well, no, he was just another guest. I didn't know who Ian Fleming was. I didn't even know that he had written a book. I think he only had one book published by that time.
Yeah, probably The Living Daylights, I think. Was that his first one? I'm not quite sure. Moving on to, so he was there 54, 55. Henry Fonda and his daughter Jane Fonda. I mean, two massive heavy hitters. Like, I'm trying to think of, for those listening who might be of younger age, this is like, you know, effectively Taylor Swift landing in Glenveagh or you know, Katy Perry and Mr. Trudeau. Like, these were massive at the time. They both arrived at the same time, did they? Again, I'm going to get the impression that you are going to find these people pretty unassuming and just nice people, right?
We wouldn't have known who they were because there was no social media in those days and we didn't have any television. Glenveagh was the worst place in the world, even though we got electric in 59.
Yes, and on it goes. And there's some fascinating stories from Patrick. And, you know, he was perfect for that job because these people coming in were, as I said in the clip there, the who's who. Ultra, ultra famous people. But he treated them just like he would have treated anybody. Some interesting stories. Obviously, then he went over to the United States and... recounts nearly being run over by Bruce Springsteen. So he's had a close encounter with the boss. So that entire podcast is available for you on our website, highlandradio.com, from 11 a.m, The Greg Hughes Podcast. And it's also available wherever you get your podcast. Just search The Greg Hughes Podcast on your preferred platform. And we've got brilliant episodes every week. A couple, I mean, Patrick's an amazing guy. Last week we had the Bells. Next week we've got another cracking guest. People you're familiar with, but maybe their stories you aren't necessarily familiar with. And maybe you're learning for the first time that Glenveagh Castle was this mecca, this retreat for the elites. As I say, if you name someone in the 50s and 60s who was famous in any area, Patrick's worked with them. That is just that's just the reality of it. And I'm delighted to welcome on to the programme the Bishop of the Diocese of Derry, Bishop Michael Reuter. Good morning to you. Thank you so very much for your time.
Good morning, Greg. Good to be with you.
Lovely to have you with us and lovely to have you in our part of the world. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
How long have you known of this appointment, Bishop?
I think it was around the very beginning of July of the month. I think the 1st of July I was called to meet the Papal Nuncio in Dublin, and he informed me that the Pope Leo had nominated me as the next Bishop of Derry. So it was quite a surprise, to be honest with you. I wasn't expecting it. You know, we've been doing a lot of work in the Archdiocese of Armagh this year in terms of our whole synodal process and leading up to a major congress that we had back in March on youth, family and faith. So we were working on that and the outcomes of that congress and putting together a pastoral plan to shape the future of the Archdiocese of Armagh in the next 7 years. So that was my whole focus, really, and it was quite a surprise to get that call and to be offered the job. Having said that, I'm really honoured and, you know, privileged to be asked to be the chief shepherd in a diocese such as Derry, such a famous diocese and such a famous place in so many ways, and such a lovely diocese in terms of its people. I was up there yesterday for the announcement and just had a, you know, I was very anxious going up and nervous, and how would I be received, because, you know, I'm very much an outsider, I suppose, in a sense there. I wouldn't know the diocese terribly well. I'd know a few people, but wouldn't have huge contacts. You know, I was afraid, but that was all put to bed very quickly with the warm welcome that I received. And, you know, the whole day was really fantastic and culminated in a walking tour with Bishop Donal around the city centre, which was full of life and atmosphere because of the match that was on last night between Derry City and CSKA Sofia from Bulgaria. So there was people gathering and that, and I was amazed at how friendly they were, and people came over, shake hands and took selfies, and Bishop Donal knew everybody. He knew so many people by first name, like, it was just incredible. He obviously very much a man of the people, and that's something that's going to be missed by the people, I think, you know, that he was so visible and was walking the streets and talking to people. And you know, I hope that I'd be able to follow in his footsteps in that way, you know.
Yeah. And obviously to focus on the position that you will take up in September, and it's hugely positive for yourself and for the people of Derry, the Derry Diocese, but also you are a human as well, and I get the impression from you that you will feel that you're leaving some unfinished work, and I'm sure there are people you can entrust and offer guidance to if required to continue the work in Armagh. But I get a very clear impression it was something that you were incredibly proud of, and perhaps timing wise you would love to have seen through to the end.
Yeah, it certainly was something that we all had pulled together in the diocese, people, the priests, The Dawson pastoral team had been, you know, working on this. It was all part of the international and the national synodal process over the past 4 to 5 years, which we'd worked very hard at. And one of the things that emerged in that, of course, was the fall away of young people, you know, from practice in the church. And that was a major concern for an awful lot of parents and grandparents and the people who took part in our synodal listening sessions and all the rest. So it certainly is you know, a central topic, something that we really have to reflect on a lot. But I was glad that I got it to the stage anyway where we had the Congress and we now have a body of work that has come from that as a matter of turning it into a pastoral plan.
Yes, and with that in mind, obviously, you know, these aren't issues that are exclusive to Armagh either, and this is knowledge and learning that you're able to bring with you to Derry, because I'm sure whatever is established or whatever is found will be a blueprint for the church across the island.
Absolutely. I mean, it is one of the central issues. We have a national assembly in October, and it would be one of the major issues that would be discussed there as well. So, you know, we can't discuss the future of the church and ignore the whole issue of evangelization, particularly of the young and of young families. And that's going to be an issue in the Diocese of Derry, the same as it will be in any diocese across the country. So, you know, it's a very important moment we're in, I think, at the moment. We have a lot of disillusionment. People are disillusioned with church, but they're also disillusioned with a lot of the institutions, I suppose, that have been, you know, respected and taken for granted over the years. And, you know, a lot of young people are questioning so much about the secular world.
Yeah, but I think also those young people, and I'm sure you found this in your work, are also seeking a purpose or a guidance or something to believe in or something to be a part of. And, you know, their parents and maybe even their grandparents, perhaps their opinions were formed with a very difficult or through a very difficult time for the church. And you know, everyone's in a rebuilding process. So I think that's a very good conversation at this time. And as I say, sometimes, you know, it can be the right time to actually give people, young people, something to believe in, something to be a part of, something to identify as.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, that's what I was kind of trying to say, that I think there is a certain disillusionment with what's on offer in secular society, you know. And I had a meeting yesterday with a group of young people from the diocese yesterday afternoon, and I asked them to tell me, now not immediately, but over probably the next few months or whatever, to organise a forum with young people and for them to tell me what they expect from the Bishop of Derry. And just their immediate reaction was that they wanted somebody who was a shepherd, who was there to give some guidance and direction and help people to make sense of all the things that are happening in our world now, which is very confusing and very, you know, threatening in many ways as well. You know, there's a lot of issues out there. So, you know, responding to that is going to be difficult. It can't be left on just the shoulders of one person. But we as a church together, both lay people and clergy and religious or whatever, we have to provide sanctuary, in a sense, for so many people to help them to sort out the issues that are difficult and cause of anxiety for so many people, and to get some direction. And leadership, in a sense, is so important in today's world. And these young people were totally for that, you know. I mean, that's what they want.
Yeah. And of course, with some, you're pushing an open door, and for others, it's a case of finding the ways to reach them as
to
well.
To reach out to them, yeah.
Yeah, Bishop McKeown will remain as apostolic administrator of Derry until you are formally installed at a ceremony in September. Between now and then you say September, you know, and time goes so quick, In my mind, it was like 9 months away. But of course, it's not. It's the month after next. So between now and then, Bishop, is it reaching out, getting to know the priest that you'll be working with, putting, you know, maybe like you talked of just now, you know, putting some measures in place to have things up and running for when you are installed, etc.?
Yeah, well, there will be an element of that very much, but I won't move actually permanently to Derry until September as such. So I still have to wind things down here and, you know, get the whole process of moving into place, which takes a bit of time. And as you say, it's only 8 to 9 weeks to the installation. So, you know, it's going to be pretty busy and pretty hectic and a lot of things to think about. But I do hope to meet the priests before that. And if possible, this forum of young people, I will have to see how that develops. But, you know, there's a lot of work to do and I haven't really got my head around it just yet.
No, it's very, very soon, you know, isn't it?
Yeah, it's early days as of yet. But I think the next few weeks are going to be pretty busy, but pretty exciting as well.
Yeah.
And you know, I look forward to the challenge. I look forward to getting to know people. And if yesterday's anything to go by, the people of Derry Diocese just seem to be so friendly and
warm. You'll get a lovely welcome. There's no doubt.
Yeah, I think
that.
So.
Of course, a human, as our priests and as our bishops and everything in between. And you always know that the call could be at any time to switch diocese or move here or move there. And I know of speaking to people in the past, they try not to put down too many roots, if you know what I mean, because then that pull can be more difficult. But then that's part of the process as well, isn't it? How difficult will it be for you to, of course, as excited as you are to move to Derry and undertake that great body of work? But is it a huge pull for you? Is it difficult for you knowing that the people that you've come to know and trust and form relationships with, that you have to a great extent break those ties?
Yeah, well, I came to the Archdiocese of Armagh from Cavan, from the Diocese of Kilmore, where I'd worked for nearly 30 years. So that was a big upheaval, because I'd spent a year in Dublin Diocese. But other than that, I'd spent most of my time actually in a fairly small geographical area in East Cavan. So it was a big wrench to actually leave there and go to Armagh, the Archdiocese of Armagh, in the first place. But, you know, there's a lot of work in getting to know people and to kind of develop your contacts and your relationships and all the rest. And you know, to get used to the job of being a bishop, which is difficult. But I mean, it's just been people of where I live in County Louth. I live just outside of Dundalk, and the people of County Louth have been really lovely to live among. And I'm living in a beautiful place, actually looking over the Cooley Mountains, so it's going to be hard to leave that as well. So it will, you know, not too far from Lordship, Ravensdale, that area. It's a lovely part of the world.
Well, wait till you see what we've got in store for you, Bishop.
Oh, I know, yes.
You are in for an absolute treat. And obviously, it's a huge honour, but it's built in with that. As I say, we're all humans, I know you're going to have a wonderful life.
I just want to say, yes? Greg, I mean, the people of the Archdiocese of Armagh have been hugely cooperative.
Yes.
And that goes right up to Armagh County and Tyrone and into Derry. So we have a little bit of experience with 4 parishes in Derry as well. You know, they have been wonderful, and I want to thank them so much, the priests and people of the Archdiocese, for all that they have done for me and all that they have taught me over the past 7 years. It's really been wonderful.
Yeah, I've no doubt you're going to get a lovely welcome and a great support to match and exceed what you enjoyed yesterday. And we wish you all the best, and we look forward to chatting to you into the future. Thank you so much.
Thanks
the day
much,
after the formal announcement, for making yourself self-available to us. It's greatly appreciated.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you.
Bless.
Now, Derry City's Europa League clash against CSKA Sofia was marred by ugly scenes at the Ryan McBride Brandywell Stadium. Some Bulgarian supporters charged the home fans minutes after Ellis Chapman had given the Candy Stripes the lead. But after a 15-minute delay, the tie restarted and Sophia, in the end, secured a narrow 2-1 win. I was contacted in advance to say there's going to be trouble in Derry tonight. And as it turned out, that was the case. Conor McGinty was at the stadium last night and joins us on the programme now. Conor, as I say, everyone seemed to anticipate this, except maybe the powers that be.
I think, thanks for having me on, Greg. I think, you know, 21 years, I'm going to the Brandywell now, watching Derry City, and it's the first time that I've ever genuinely felt unsafe in the Brandywell. The week before the game, you know, it was clear to see online that CSK Sofia, their actual pages online, their official pages, were allowing their fans to insult and intimidate Derry people all week, calling us peasants, mocking the city, saying that they weren't coming for the football. They were calling Derry City people incests. One of the quotes in particular was, "Crush these lower peasants." Mm-hmm. I've lived there and there's no more disgusting place in the world. Peasants, sheep and stupidity.
And they did charge the Derry City fans, and thankfully, just because the way things are now in modern football, Derry fans were able to, shouldn't have had to, but were able to escape out onto the pitch. I mean,
yeah,
it could have been very, very different.
I was on the pitch with my father first time. I sit in Block H, which isn't far from Block G and the barrier from where it happened. You know, with my own eyes, I seen the ultras ripping up the seats, rushing Derry fans the minute that Ellis Chapman scored. You know, young Wayne's running towards the north stand area, families on the pitch. You know, it was the first time, maybe I'm wrong with this quote, I think I'm right, the first time since 1985 that the police have entered the Brandywell. You know, that was the scale of it. And at the end of the day, a blind man could see it coming. Two clicks of a button on YouTube would let you know how CSK Sofia fans behave in Europe regularly. And I think, you know, it's really important to say as well here that the way that the PSNA handled this before the match on Bishop Street was absolutely disgraceful. You know, escorting Bulgarians, ultras, CSK Sofia fans past the Oak Grove Bar in Derry where fans are gathered, families are outside, you know, there's a safer route that exists along the Foy Road, which was used after the game. Why was that not considered? Do you know? And a question needs to be asked: who made that routing call, and are they going to be held accountable?
Yeah, indeed. And unfortunately, you know, we should be reflecting on the game itself, albeit that not exactly the result anyone was looking for. But there is still European options for Derry. Yep. Some valid questions and questions. Yeah, go ahead, please.
I think, you know, what has to be said too is it was an absolutely amazing atmosphere. It was one of the best atmospheres I've ever witnessed in the Brandywell since I started going when I was 13. You know, Derry players outplayed CSK Sofia in the first half. Mm. Only for that disruption, I think we would have went on to the second leg in Europa League. Credit to the Derry City chairman, Fulbert Doherty, and the Simpsons and the directors and everything that they're doing to try and bring that experience in the Brandywell for families and make it open for families, and the new screen that they put up and the atmosphere that was created, it was incredible.
Okay.
Also, if you're going to be calm and decent and balanced about this, there's definitely, you know, credit to the stewards and the officials last night and what they did, but there is a real issue around security resourcing in the Brandywell, and it has been coming.
Yeah,
you know, obviously
the warning signs were there.
The funny situation with,
well, listen, yeah, let this not be the warning that is not heeded. Thanks, Conor, for your insight, and I'm glad that you and your dad were okay. It's a shame that evening that event was spoiled. Gavin Boyle and Pat Conahan, directors of the Mary from Dunlow International Arts Festival, are with me. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning, Greg.
How in unison you've been working so closely together. You're like a choir now. Right, things get underway on the 25th of July and run till Monday, the 3rd of August, 2026. It's a true 10-day celebration of one of Ireland's longest-running cultural festivals. Gavin, all the hard work has been done now. You've been working on this for a long time, and I'm sure you've got a close eye on next year as well. So everything's in place. Just get people along to enjoy it now.
Yeah, really, we have. We took 2 weeks off after the festival last year and went straight back into it again. And we have about 130 events for this year's festival over the 10 days, and we're looking forward to getting it started at this stage. Yeah, it would be great.
Pat, the weather's going to play ball too by the looks of things as well, which is the always the one thing you've, as good as you and Gavin are, that's the one thing you can't always guarantee. But it doesn't really dampen spirits anyway, but it's nice when it's nice.
Yeah, it does make a huge difference. I think, I suppose, the big day really is the final Sunday where we have the parade. Like the police reckoned last year, there was somewhere in the region of 12 to 14,000 on the street. And I mean, that does make a difference. We're very lucky in that we have a lot. Like we have, you know, we have different marquees. We move things indoors if we have to. The local community, we have the CDP, we have the Innet there. We have the Hallamore, and we have the Rosses Community School are great because they give us rooms. They let us use their sports hall for the Crown and Cabaret. So we do have a lot of indoor, but as you say, the weather makes it.
And it all begins, and I've said these to you previously, I love the way that you're selecting people to open such a prestigious festival. Enda and Tricia McCarry get the honour this year, Gavin.
Yeah, we're thrilled. We've always tried to get community people that are involved in the community to open the festival because they don't get recognised sometimes for the work that they do in the background. And Enda and Tricia both really have been involved for about 40 years or so. I think they actually met at the festival themselves. Enda's part of the fire brigade. Tricia is a local postwoman. They're involved in anything and everything really in the town. And we think that it's a deserved recognition for them to open the festival this year.
There's so much going on. Where do we start? I mean, obviously, we have the cabaret that was mentioned and all the events. But where do we start with what's going on? I think it's a case of getting yourself to Dunlow on any of the days or all of the days, isn't it?
It is. Well, check out the brochure. The brochure is available throughout the county. It's available online. And I was chatting to a lady this morning from Dublin, and she's saying every day she was looking for different stuff for the likes of the kids. We're trying to get as much kids events and as possible. Happy kids or happy parents, and then they're happy out as well. So we're trying to get as many kids events in as we have. We've introduced Lego animation, we've introduced many races, loads of new events, the teddy making, the arts, all of that. There's all their music classes, and it's trying to get all of those and people happy, but there's loads to do for everybody. We're trying to get every demographic covered if we can.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you've achieved that. And if you pick up the brochure too, by the way, there is a lovely map done low. It's a well laid out village, of course, town. But in terms of parking and where things are and all that type of stuff, so you can go with the knowledge of, and there is plenty of parking around the place as well. The Marys are, I'm sure, awaiting with bated breath for things to really truly get underway. But they've been busy up until now already.
Yeah, they've been on tour already. They've been on tour actually this last month. We found it in previous years when before we were involved. They came for the 10 days of the festival. But during that 10 days, most days they were out of town and a lot of people weren't seeing them. And then it was such a busy day for them. They were away all day. Then they were expected to come back and they were really exhausted. So we decided, let's do a lot of more pre-tours now. So, they were visiting Donegal Town, they were visiting Glenveagh, you know, all the spots that around the county, Sleeve League. And I think it got the momentum going early this year as well. And it meant then that when the festival comes, I think they're only away maybe 2 half-days.
Yeah, and so in that process too, you're, by accident or by design, developing a whole crop of incredibly articulate ambassadors for the county as well, Gavin.
Very much so. And it also gives them an opportunity to get to know one another before they arrive. Because they're coming from all places, America. Our New York Mary's actually here already. She was with us in Newbridge on Tuesday in Kildare. So they're coming from all over England, Scotland, Ireland and the USA. And they're getting an opportunity to get to know one another as well and for them to showcase what we have.
Brilliant. And they're still going to come in and chat to us, are they?
They are indeed.
Excellent. I know that's really popular with our listeners. Yeah. And it must astound you that year after year after year, these amazing young women put themselves forward, Pat. You know, maybe taking career breaks or educational breaks while they're here. Yeah. But they're all just fantastic people to a person.
They are. It's just,
I haven't met them, but I know because it's always the way.
Yeah, they're such a variety. Like, as I said, we were in Kildare Village and in Newbridge during the week, and we were obviously took different cars, and there was I had three of the girls in the back, and like just listening to their conversation. I mean, one of the Marys was just she'd just become a lawyer, and another Mary was had just got a new job, and she's working in fertility in clinics, and you know, just the variety of girls, and they're so interesting, and they just bring so much to the competition.
So, as well as the stage, there's a ton of venues. Yeah. Local businesses have entertainment on throughout the course of the festival as well. Yeah. A lot of daytime stuff on the street. You know, it's a beautiful space just to mull around. And as you say, pick up the brochure, Gavin, yeah. And you'll find lots to do. Because as you guys have actively want this to be very family orientated.
Yeah. We do, yeah. As I say, we're trying to cover all demographics and keep them interested in it and keep them around the town for the day as well. We've introduced a few new events this year. Obviously, we've our food fair, which is coming back on the Monday. And we also have our Naughty Naughties brunch, which is seeming to be very popular in the county throughout. That's on this opening Saturday from 3 to 6 for anybody that wants to get out early and get home early and all of that there. Our busking competition's back. Loads of stuff for everybody.
Yeah, we really cannot. We really cannot go through it. Such as the
not at all. We'd be here.
And some of the headline events. Is there any shortages of tickets? You know, for the big event, just in case people are minded, patterns don't miss out.
I suppose the main ones that we have Neil Delamere coming on the Monday this year,
which is brilliant. Yeah,
both of us are great fans of his, and both of us have been to him. We said, God, I wonder, should we try? Thinking he'd never come to West Donegal, but fair dues, his calendar suited, and he said he would come. There are very limited amount of tickets. We were amazed how popular it is. We also have a new Night at the Opry as well on the Wednesday night. Tickets are flying for that. So they're the kind of two main ticketed events, and obviously the Crown and Cabaret again is very limited as well. That those tickets are
Of the things that Pat's referenced are going to sell out. It's just a case of whether you get one of the last tickets if you're minded to go, Gavin. Yeah.
Donegal people are very I'll leave it. And we start to panic then because we know that's what they're like,
and
we see the tickets selling. And we still know that there are people that haven't got it. So if you haven't got tickets for an event that you want to go to, please try to get it as soon as you can.
And is there a one-stop shop for all information? I mean, obviously the brochure's there, right? But you talked about information being available online in this day and age. Obviously that's critical for people for planning and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we have our website, maryfromdunlow.ie, and our socials, be it our Facebook page, Instagram page, TikTok. We're all quite active.
And give those a follow, by the way, because it'll be hugely entertaining for you over the course of the festival as well, if you can't get away. Because, I mean, obviously social media is a great means to promote and get information out there, but it's also fantastic for people who can't be there to feel connected to it as well. And we know that from what we do here too. So it's double-barreled. Listen, thanks for calling over.
Thanks.
It's going to be fantastic. We look forward to it. We're going to be broadcasting live from it next Friday. And we'll have the Marys in with us as well too. So lots of Mary from Dunlow content on Highland Radio over the next few weeks, and it's fantastic that that's the case. But for now, Pat Conaghan, thank you.
Thank you, Greg.
Gavin Ball, thank you. Thanks, he's both look fresh and young, considering.
Give us 2 weeks.
Right, we'll be back with you on Monday morning at 9 o'clock.